Hi there. Today I'm here with Samuel Colvin. Samuel is known for creating Pydantic, and I'm very excited to talk to you. He's currently based in London, the same time zone as me. How is it going, Samuel?
Yeah, it's good. It's good. Yeah, nice to meet you.
Thank you for taking the time. Yeah, as I said, you are the creator of Pydantic, which is a data validation library for Python. Could you give us a brief overview of what it is and how it compares to like things like data classes or MyPy or TY, which was released quite recently?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, Pydantic now does a whole bunch of things that goes beyond just data validation. But if we talk about Pydantic validation, the original library started life way back in 2017 as an experiment, really. Type hints had just come out in Python, and but obviously it's very weird that type hints don't do anything at runtime. If you were like thinking from first principles early on in your software development training, you would expect that these variables that you have in the code would be enforced at runtime. It would be some kind of error to initialize a data class where it says name is a string with name as a number. But because of Python's history and because of how typing is gradual and it's fundamentally an untyped language with static typing on top, types don't do anything at runtime in general. But unlike in TypeScript, those types are accessible at runtime, as in within the code, as you're running Python code, you can go and access the Dunder annotations attribute of a class, and you can access the raw annotations. And therefore, if you write enough code, you can go and enforce them. You can enforce that the name field is a string and that the date of birth field is a date. And so effectively, that's what Pydantic does. The other big difference is to some of the other validation libraries is we will do coercion. So if you give us the string 123 to an integer field, we will coerce it to 123. But we'll also coerce a string of an ISO 8601 date into a date object. Now, it turns out that in some cases is very, very important because lots of formats where we receive data like JSON or environment variables or URL parameters only have a limited subset of types. So JSON can have strings, integers, floats, but it can't have date objects. Environment variables or URL arguments can only be strings. And so we need that coercion to be able to construct types properly. On top of the pure validation, we have advanced control over serialization. So going back from a Pydantic model to JSON or to a dict, and also we can generate stuff like JSON schema. And I suppose it's like those three components together that mean Pydantic is so widely used both in general development and in AI stuff.
Got it. You mentioned the type annotations are accessible with the Dunder values in Python. And if I remember correctly, there was a PEP, like a Python Enhancement Protocol or proposal, that put that in danger.
Long ago, there was some discussion in Python 3.7 that the attributes would still be available, but they would be always strings. And for the most part, that's fine because you can convert from a string if it's like the string int to the integer type. But there are some situations, in particular with advanced closures, where you need the cell reference done properly from Python to access what the annotation is. And so there were some discussions about changing how Python works. There was some back and forth, and we ended up Python didn't change it that way. So we now have a new way of basically getting the overheads of type annotations removing the overhead of type annotations without losing the functionality.
So what is that new way?
Very complicated for the most part. It doesn't matter. Fundamentally, closures are stored as a closure, and so as a function, so that you can access them by calling that function. Vast majority of Python code doesn't change, but we do some clever stuff in the background to be able to define them. So one of the big problems is that if you want to access, let's say I have a data class and I want to access the type of that data class during its definition, then that data class type does not exist yet. And so I cannot have access to it while I'm defining it. So if they had just become strings, then all of that stuff goes away. The closure solution effectively allows me to, when I come and call that function, I can get access to that annotation when I come to call it, but when I just define it in code, I don't have to do any like nasty putting strings around the type annotation to work around this problem.
Got it. So basically, Pydantic is like the wrapper around all these glue code that you need to access those values and do useful stuff with that?
I think we do an awful lot more than that now. As in, so today, yeah. Pydantic is like 40,000 lines of Rust in the core, and then I don't know how many lines of Python code to do the like converting it. So fundamentally, it's a like very fast optimized validation and coercion library in Rust, which is generally populated from Python type annotations.
Can you recall the moment where you said, okay, enough pain, I need to create a Python library for that?
Yeah, I mean it was way back 2017. I was trying to pass some HTTP headers and I was frustrated that I kept having to duplicate things. So I would have the type annotation because I wanted typing, and I would also have whatever validation library you're using, you need to go and also define, oh, and this thing is going to be a string. And it seems very unfortunate that you have two sources of truth on what types things are. And so it was just this like mad idea. Would it be even possible to access the annotation and build a library that used the annotation and then enforced it?
Yeah. Did you foresee back in the day how big it would become?
No, not at all. I always say I would have thought a lot longer about the name and probably come up with a worse name if I had known that it was not only going to become a very widely used library, but also a company and then, you know, dominate a lot of my life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, AWS saw some value in it. If I recall correctly, they
I think every large company in the world uses it, because if you're using Python and you want to use type annotations at the boundaries of your code, they have no effect. So whether you're reading a CSV file, validating the response from an LLM, parsing an API, parsing environment variables, anything where you're interpreting external data, you need some kind of validation, and it makes sense that validation is defined from type annotations, and Pydantic is the kind of preeminent way of doing that.
Absolutely. At which point did it become a company?
So I started working full-time on Pydantic. So the rewrite from Python to Rust, so the core of Pydantic is all implemented in Rust. I started that rewrite at the beginning of 2022. About 8 months into what I thought was going to be a three-month project, I was like half done, wondering how I was ever going to finish it. And I got this very nice email out of the blue from Bogomil at Sequoia asking to talk. Had a few conversations. They invested and I started a company. And so, yeah, we started the company formally at the very, very end of 2022.
So that is a VC-backed company. You mentioned the Sequoia. Yeah. So how did that play along? I mean, there are a couple of questions arising from that. Like the first of all is the developer's perspective. Like some people would see like there is a risk in using a VC-backed libraries. How would you respond to that?
I mean, there's a risk in using any library in that it could be abandoned or it could be no longer actively maintained or, you know, lots of strategic risks, whether it is a like solo developer doing it for their love, whether it is a VC-backed company or whether it be a large corporation. I mean, you see lots of libraries that are maintained by someone in their spare time for love that end up being abandoned. You see lots of open source projects maintained by Google and Amazon that end up being abandoned in some ways more arbitrarily than a startup. So, and I can tell you, I would not be actively maintaining Pydantic or as much as we do now if I wasn't paid for it. Like, you cannot earn a good tech salary from maintaining open source. And so it would not, the library was not, would not be as good. It would not be as actively maintained if we weren't a company. Yeah. It's very easy to be sort of borderline communist about how open source should work when you don't maintain a library and, or where, when you're well paid in another tech role. Most people who I speak to who are active maintainers of open source, they may have taken investment, they may not have taken investment, but they understand the like trade-offs in that. Today Pydantic validation is still completely open source, MIT licensed, actively maintained by me and other experts. So I think it's beyond any doubt that it's better for the better for the user base that we have investment to maintain it with.
Looks like we are facing some technical difficulties here.
I was talking about Pydantic and why I think it is better maintained as open source, but I think I finished my answer to that question, and we can go on from there.
Then how does Pydantic make money then if it's a company?
So we have built, on top of Pydantic validation, the library, we have Pydantic AI, which is the agent framework. So library for building applications with AI. And then on top of that, which again is completely open source. And then we have Pydantic Logfire, which is our observability platform. So today we're like general observability, but with first-class support for AI. An awful lot of people think of us as an AI observability platform, although fundamentally it's observability for all of your Python application and even beyond that into any other language, because we're built on OpenTelemetry. And so we believe in like full-bore, real, clear open source, closed source divide. And so Pydantic validation, Pydantic AI are completely open source and MIT licensed. And then Logfire, actually our SDK again is open source and MIT licensed, but the platform is closed source, and that's how we make our money, both SaaS and self-hosting.
Yeah, I saw it. You mentioned it like on the homepage of Logfire. It says it's a complete observability platform for your AI apps, even though it's like a observability platform for any developer projects, yep. Right? That marketing speak, or is the market for human dev tools like gone?
So I think it is humans who are still building these applications. But I think more and more we see our market as for like where people buy Logfire is for AI applications. I think for a large part that is because what new applications are people building in Python? Most of them are Gen AI, as in it's fairly rare today that you're going and building a new application and there's no AI involved at all, either in the development side or within your application.
Yeah, totally fine. I want to come back a little bit to the VC backing of Pydantic. So if you're like a developer creating a library or some kind of dev tool, what would your advice be? Like actively seeking out a VC or just waiting for a VC to contact you?
I think
you,
it's like been great. I've been very lucky
for bootstrapping.
Yeah, and I ran a bootstrap business before, and I see the advantages of both. I will say I really enjoy running a company where I have the resources to pay the people I most respected as open source developers very well to work on building the Pydantic stack. I'm very lucky. I have Sequoia as an investor, who are both one of the most best known VCs, perhaps the best known VC, but also have been great. Bogomil in particular have been amazing to work with. I'm not saying everyone is as lucky as me in terms of the experience they have with investors, but I suppose I'll say I've had it as good as it comes in terms of the investors I've had. But I would thoroughly recommend it if you get the experience I've had. It's awesome. I think that there are lots of people now who go and build open source expecting to be able to get VC investment a few weeks or months later. And some of them get lucky and that works out. And some of them are probably disappointed. People ask always, why is Pydantic have $500 million downloads a month? How did you do that with your VC-backed company? And it's because I ran it for 5 years before that happened, right? We have this enormous foundation of how everyone uses Pydantic. And you cannot get 5 years of market penetration or 5 years of experience overnight. So I think
absolutely.
That while I would encourage people to take VC money, I think it's not a question. It's more people building open source for the sake of VC than people starting off with open source and then wondering about VC most of the time.
Yeah. So apart from getting the money from Sequoia, what else do they contribute to the success of the company?
So I think that the second biggest thing that they deliver in reality is that their reputation, as in if I go and speak to someone, whether that be a potential hire or a potential customer or a potential collaboration, it immediately gives us credibility that we wouldn't have if we didn't have a like big name behind us like that. And then I think the third thing is having the advice of someone who's an expert in the market, like Bogomil, is incredibly valuable, who, you know, wants the same outcomes as we want. That's very useful.
Yeah, got it. And I know your answer might be biased because you are building a Python library, actually. But what is the state of Python these days? Because it seems like everyone is talking about TypeScript. Python is losing a little bit of traction, gaining in other areas some. So what is your take on that?
I think that there are some people in the TypeScript space who would like to say that Python is losing market share. The evidence is, the quantitative evidence is to the contrary. If you look at download numbers, I think if you take, for example, the OpenAI SDK in Python and TypeScript, that company has no particular affiliation with one of those languages. So it seems like a good neutral comparison. I think that the Python SDK has 4x more downloads than the TypeScript one. So all things being equal, ballpark, Python is 4 times more widely used in AI than TypeScript. There's an awful lot of like hype monkeys of Silicon Valley who came from being front-end hype monkeys and moved into being AI hype monkeys because that's where the money was. No one gives a damn about which web framework I'm going to use or which front-end framework I'm going to use. So instead, they like bike shed about which agent framework I'm going to use in TypeScript. I think for the most part, it is not a technical choice. That is that's what they knew. I mean, my take it, look, TypeScript's a great language. I have an awful lot of respect for it. I use it. I enjoy writing it. The problem with TypeScript is not the language, it's the people. It is incredibly hard to find good TypeScript developers. And many of the people shrilling for why TypeScript is better are technical charlatans whose opinions I don't particularly want to listen to. And whereas there's an awful lot of credible, decent people building in Python. If you look at what one of the like lesser known or less obvious, less discussed, but I think absolute effects of the last 5 years is that Python has become the like boring language of enterprise. Where it used to be Java and C++, no one is credibly building like AI applications in Java or C++ anymore. But those big corporations are not using TypeScript either, for the most part. So Python has like basically quietly become the big boring language of enterprise. That means it's incredibly valuable. It affects all of our lives a lot every day, but perhaps it's not as sexy as the latest thing happening in JavaScript.
But it has a great community to it.
Yeah. No, and look, I think that the situation in Python is only getting better, right? As in obviously the biggest change to the Python landscape over the last few years has been the stuff Astral have done, Ruff, then UV, and now TY. I think, I'm biased, but I think what Pydantic has done in terms of our corner of how people build with Python has been pretty influential. I think that the FFI interface in Python is still like indisputably better than it is in TypeScript. And so we get to go and implement bits in Rust or in C. And NumPy, again, is like there is no equivalent of NumPy in the JavaScript TypeScript ecosystem by popularity. Mm.
Absolutely. Yes, you mentioned Astral. So what they are doing and what Pydantic is doing as well is building their backend in Rust. So Rust is another language that gained some popularity. It's maybe sometimes dealt as the successor for C, C++, because it's a compiled language. So why did you choose Rust to build a library dedicated to Python developers?
Well, we wanted performance improvements and finer-grained control, which you get in Rust. So it's not just performance, but although performance is obviously a big factor. So one of the nice things about Rust, not nice when you're just trying to hack something together, but nice when you're trying to build a library, is that you are forced to catch effectively every error that something might raise. One of the problems in Python, one of its shortcomings, in my opinion, is that I go and call request.get, let's say. What exceptions might that raise? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can start going through them. It might raise a value error because of invalid inputs. It might raise a type error because of the wrong number of inputs. It might raise an OS error because it can't do a DNS lookup. It might raise a request error. It might raise a request error will have like 15 different subtypes of error from status code through to invalid URL, whatever it might be. The point is, it's very hard to know what errors you're going to get, let alone there is no linting or no way of guaranteeing you've caught all of those errors. If you're writing a nice script, that doesn't matter. Maybe you put try except all exceptions around request.get. Catching all exceptions is probably bad, but you get the idea. You can probably sort it out. But where you're building a validation library like Pydantic, where you want to be very specific about the exact behavior in the case of every error, Rust allows you to do that. You have to go and catch every error or worst, put the question mark on the end and propagate that error But even then, the error has to be, you know, has to implement the into trait for the error on that particular function. So you're forced to go and process every error, and that's very, very valuable. And of course, the performance is the other big one. So Pydantic, in, you know, if you're like parsing an HTTP request, probably it doesn't matter. Any realistic schema, even with Pydantic V1 or the libraries that predate it, you're probably going to do the validation in under 1 millisecond. If you're caring about the user's end experience, you know, one extra millisecond doesn't make any difference. Maybe now you use Pydantic V2, you've got that down to like hundreds of microseconds. Great. But when you're going to go and use one of these libraries for parsing millions of rows of a CSV file or a Parquet file, now you really care about the performance. And the only way to get that performance with flexibility in Python is through implementing it in a lower level language. The only three candidates for that are C, C++, and Rust. And I mean, the Boost bindings for Python and the C++ bindings for Python are not that well maintained anymore. I think all of the work is going into Rust. I think there isn't much debate. I mean, you think about how Rust is the only language other than C that's allowed in the Linux kernel. Sure, there will be C++ fans who say C++ is a better option, but for the most part, I think that there is a good consensus that Rust is the spiritual successor to C, and I, for one, don't want to write that much C. I mean, and then the other bit of that is C is not considered, well, it's not a type-safe language, and we have had enough examples of memory errors in Python, in tech, that we know it's a bad idea to go and implement complex libraries in C, unless they are going to be very, very heavily reviewed and read, both run and then reviewed by people. So Python itself has a bunch of C. That's not ideal. I think it would be better if Python was implemented in a language like Rust, but the fact is it's in C, but it's been heavily enough used that we can be reasonably confident we're not going to have a memory error. Pydantic, on the other hand, sure, now maybe we used enough that if we were implemented in C, people would have some confidence, but I wouldn't want to maintain a library like that where I was relying on my expertise to avoid memory errors. So I use Rust, and I don't have to worry effectively about that case of errors.
Yeah. So basically you are left with Rust if you prefer like a modern language. Is it because Rust is the only modern language that has bindings to Python that it would allow for such things? Is there any particular reason why other languages, for example, Go, wouldn't have those bindings? Is that like a community consensus, or is there any technical limitations to it?
I don't know enough about the internals of Go to know whether it would be possible. Go is a garbage collected language, and I think that would be hard to integrate with the garbage collector of Python. But also the performance of Go is not going to match the performance of Rust. Ultimately, you're going to get assembly out of Rust that is on a par with what you get with C. Some cases where that won't be the case, but for the most part, you can make that assumption. Again, I would use the Linux kernel as another comparison, right? No other language has been allowed into the Linux kernel apart from C until Rust came along, where I think there is a belief that it is stable, that it has the right design decisions. It ultimately emits the right kind of assembly code that we can allow it into the Linux kernel. And that is why the PyO3 project, to allow you to build Python extensions in Rust, is so actively maintained and so well respected. And there's lots of community support around it, but there's also big organizations like Goldman Sachs who are building a lot of stuff for Python in Rust using PyO3 because there is a consensus that it's the best option today.
Yeah, absolutely. Got it. I want to quickly circle back about like the history of Pydantic a little bit, like from the perspective of community. You mentioned it briefly. It took 5 years to build that reputation, to build that rate of adoption. If someone's building an open source library, what would your advice be for like making your product or your library popular?
I think the first thing is it's a marathon, not a sprint. It's very easy to think I've been working on something for a week and it's in a good state, and why don't other people just go and adopt it? But if you put yourself in the mindset of even you, when you're using someone else's library, you just want it to just work, and you want it to carry on being around in 5 years' time or 10 years' time, let alone if you get into a big enterprise where those longevity concerns, those security concerns are only heightened. And so building a library that has trust, that really gets widespread adoption, is not something that happens overnight, even with AI. Even if you could, in theory, spit out the perfect library that does some task perfectly, people are rightly going to be suspicious. If it hasn't been around for that long, how much longer is it going to, you know, how long is it going to be around? And so I think the first thing you have to accept is that, like, there is no shortcut to building the credibility of that. I mean, as someone who's built one of those libraries, I find it's slightly quicker. But, you know, we released Pydantic AI a year ago. We've seen extraordinary fast adoption, I think. But we're still, you know, we have to accept that fundamentally we're still early. I think the other things around that space that can build trust are things like going to version one at a reasonable time. So not too early, but also not too late. And then caring about avoiding breaking changes. I know we made some breaking changes in Pydantic V2, but at least we followed SEMVAR. But also we learned a lot from that. And now we're very careful about avoiding breaking changes as much as possible. But I also think, I mean, yeah, I think it comes down to that longevity piece, which often involves build the thing you want to use. Build the thing that you're happy to care, that you're prepared to care about again in 5 or 10 years' time. Because if it's... You're going to maintain this thing for longer than the average marriage if it really succeeds, and so you've got to care about it. And I think this idea, you know, sure, there are situations where you can go and get a whole lot of stars on GitHub and get a whole lot of traction and a whole lot of like ego boost pretty quickly, but that's not the same as building a foundational part of the Python ecosystem.
Love that perspective. I mean, that's what libraries come down to. Eventually. So how did you do it? Like, did you post it on Hacker News every other week? Or did you cold reach out to people or companies saying, hey, I've built that thing, want to try it? Or how did it work for you?
I've never cold reached out to a company over an open source. And I don't think I've ever adopted an open source where people have cold reached out to me saying, please try my open source. I understand why that is something that might seem tempting. And, you know, I suppose in the era of more and more financial open source, it makes sense, but it's not the way I work, at least. I hope I posted it on Hacker News. It got a bunch more traction then than I think anything else I've posted immediately. As in, I was lucky; it got picked up very early on. But the, you know, the adoption was relatively slow, at least relative to today, right, and through until the beginning of 2021. I think one of the big things that happened was my friend Sebastian, FastAPI, Sebastian Ramirez, picked up Pydantic and used it in FastAPI in, I'm going to say 2019, I think. Maybe it was the end of 2018, but sometime around then. Okay. That probably, although that has always represented a relatively small percentage of our downloads, it probably is how a lot of people found out about Pydantic. I mean, FastAPI is massively popular in terms of eyeballs, obviously, and in usage as well. And so, yeah, that was how a lot of people probably found out about it. But earlier on, I don't know. I mean, I think people were interested in, I was right time, right place. I think that was part of it. Like, type annotations were coming along. We were the first people to do this. We did it well enough. I think I made some pragmatic engineering decisions, like the coercion, which lots of people would say was technically not validation and was not technically correct, but is incredibly useful in many scenarios.
Got it. So, and what would be the next steps for Pydantic and Logfire and the whole ecosystem that you've built with that?
We're still actively working on Pydantic validation. So we have late materialization. So basically the data stays as Rust types until you access the attribute that should come in the next minor release, which we will put that behind a new type called struct. Again, we care a lot about not breaking changes, so we will have struct, will come alongside base model, and we'll give another, hopefully, 3x in performance improvement. So at that point, it should be faster to initialize a struct than a data class, even though we will have all of the validation. We won't guarantee that in all cases, but we're in that ballpark now. We're going to make a few tweaks to Pydantic to improve the error messages, for example, because we know an awful lot of the errors end up being passed to an LLM. So we're going to be a little bit more explicit, make them easier for developers and easier for LLMs. And then in terms of the rest of the stuff, Pydantic AI, we have a really exciting, that library is moving very, very fast. Lots of exciting stuff coming up. Some of the stuff I'm most excited about is the JEPA integration for prompt and agent optimization. Another thing that plays into that that will come from Logfire is managed variables. So the capacity to have both prompt management and like feature flag control, but effectively variables that you control from within Logfire that are then used within your application. So you can kind of remote control your application, and that will play into the optimization piece. But like, so we'll have both the like both the like human control of those variables and the kind of self-driving optimization stuff will land. We have very good support for offline evals in Logfire and Pydantic AI today. I think we will have the online eval stuff will land sometime next year. I'm excited about that. And some other stuff that I'm not going to talk about yet because we'll make announcements next year.
Okay, cool. Do you accept like PRs from like individual contributors?
Yeah, and I think particularly in Pydantic AI, some enormous percentage of contributions are from individuals or external companies. So we work with, for example, I know the European cloud provider OVH have done a bunch of contributions recently. We've worked with even people like Guido. Guido, obviously the creator of Python, is a user of Pydantic AI and in fact uses Logfire, and Guido has given us a bunch of feedback, and we've definitely considered his feedback. In fact, embeddings generation is another big thing that will land in Pydantic AI, and Guido was gave us like his viewpoint on how to do that, and which was really useful. So, yeah, both in terms of lots of pull requests from external contributors and companies, and some like feedback from people like Guido has been super valuable.
So what makes a good contribution if I'm like an individual open source contributor? How do I get involved into Pydantic?
The first thing not to do is point your AI of choice at something and just like put together some AI slop and submit it. If it was that easy, we would be doing it. So please don't just point cursor at whatever the issue is and think that submitting that pull request is going to be a solution. If you do not understand every line of code, don't submit a pull request to any of our libraries, please. Sure, everyone uses AI in places. I use them a lot, but like that's not how you contribute to these stable libraries. I think that the best solutions are where people scratch their own itch, as in they have a thing they want and they can be opinionated about how it should work and they should go and submit that contribution. And then I think the other part is like it comes with like in the end, it needs a bit of trust. So often it's good to start with some small pull requests, implement some useful things. Once you've got those few smaller PRs merged, you'll probably learn a bunch from doing that and then maybe try and like bite off something a bit more difficult to do. Don't start with like some enormous feature and go and spend days implementing it and then submit the PR, because that often won't result in your best experience for you or the easiest experience for us.
Got it. And in terms of the company, are you hiring for positions? Oh, sorry.
I was just gonna finish on the previous point. I don't know if this is a universal advice, but definitely in the case of Pydantic and all of our libraries, I'd strongly encourage people to join our Slack, which is very active, both with our team replying and also community members replying to stuff. And if you're wondering about submitting a pull request, probably the first step is join the Slack and ask a question and say, "Shall I submit this?" And we should get a reply. I know. And I would try that on any project big enough to have some kind of chat interface, because sure, if you don't get a reply, so be it. But if you do get a reply, that'll be super helpful. I think you asked about whether or not we were hiring. We are hiring. I think we might actually, so we were hiring for someone to work on Pydantic AI on the open source at the moment. I think we actually have someone. I'm not on top of that piece of hiring, so I think we might have someone for that role. Also hiring for a kind of designer cross with front-end developer. Again, I think we may have someone for that role in the later stages of interviewing. But like, I would keep watching our socials and our careers page, because we're hiring fairly regularly.
Okay, what would be an outstanding resume for you? What would be an ideal candidate?
So I think that experience of open source is super valuable. Obviously, experience in industry of like impressive companies helps, but like the easiest thing to get if you don't have that is like impressive record of open source contribution. I mean, beyond that, we really don't have any like qualification requirements. We care about bright people who live in the right time zone and are prepared to work hard. I don't think, you know, we don't give a damn whether you have a degree, what your degree is in. We care about ability fundamentally and how good you are at communicating with a team. But I would say an open source, strong open source pedigree is the single most valuable thing you can do. I will say, don't think you're going to get a job from us by submitting 2 pull requests. If if you're passionate about contributing to the project, that's great. And we would love to have those contributions. And we have had people who've joined the team having started off by submitting pull requests. But I would say you need to enjoy those pull requests and be doing that for a couple of months before we're really going to look for a role. Don't think that you can like submit 2 typo pull requests and send in your CV and we'll hire you off the bat. That's not how it works.
So there's no automatism. Got it. Okay. I know your time is limited today. That was a lot of value. Thank you so much for your time. That was really awesome. Just one last question. What is a good way for people to reach out to you? Are you on X or LinkedIn? What do you prefer?
Reach out on X if you will. Email me, samuel@pydantic.dev or engineering@pydantic.dev if you have questions. Join our Slack and even DM me there. LinkedIn, by all means, follow me, but please don't expect if you message me that I will reply. I'm not always, I think we all have seen the state of the LinkedIn DM system, and I don't promise to reply there. So yeah, I would say Blue Sky, X, email, Slack, or LinkedIn if you really must.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much, and Merry Christmas.
No problem. Merry Christmas. Thank you so much.